Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the December 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program today. I'll begin with this article, Soaring Ambition, How Falling Water Gave Frank Lloyd Wright's Career a Second Wind, by Michael Schneider. In 1995, when Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water was less than 60 years old, a group of engineers traveled to the rural highlands outside Pittsburgh to inspect the house's iconic cantilevered terraces, thrust out over their waterfall in defiance of gravity, and, as it turned out, of good sense. Even before construction was completed in 1937, cracks had appeared in the concrete parapets. By the mid-1990s, the balconies had sagged in some places by more than 7 inches. You could feel them bounce. It was like a diving board, says Linda Wagoner, who started guiding tours at Falling Water as a teenager in 1965 and served as the house museum's director from 1996 to 2018. The extravagant gesture that made Falling Water the most famous modern house in the United States had nearly brought the entire magnificent structure crashing down. Hailed almost immediately as Wright's masterpiece, Falling Water was also an uncomfortably apt metaphor for a difficult period in the architect's career. Wright's earlier houses, with their open floor plans and horizontal thrust, had helped revolutionize early 20th century architecture. When images of those so-called prairie houses traveled to Berlin in 1910, future godfathers of architectural modernism, like Ludwig Mies, von Rohr, and Walter Gropius, were astounded. Wright had taken the massive structures of the 19th century and exploded them outward, with long, low roof lines that seemed to float free from the walls below. Back in the Midwestern U.S., Wright's caustic approach to clients and his disregard for convention, including his choice in 1909 to abandon his family and run off with the wife of a former client, made him persona non grata among his patrons. By the 1920s, Wright's hipped roofs and elaborate ornamentation had come to seem almost quaint compared with the glossy, streamlined sophistication of European modernism. When the newly founded Museum of Modern Art, or MoMA, in New York, mounted its landmark 1932 exhibition on modern architecture, the curators relegated Wright to the role of a half-modern precursor to the real revolution, which they dubbed the international style. Wright, hungry for adulation and desperate for work, was enraged by the slight. "I find myself rather a man without a country, architecturally speaking," he complained in a letter to the architect Philip Johnson, a co-curator of the MoMA show. Falling Water, commissioned in 1934 as a vacation home by department store magnate Edgar Kaufman Sr., would be Wright's opportunity to beat the internationalists at their own game, as he repeatedly said at the time. There in the Appalachian backwoods, Wright took key elements of modernism, like cantilevers, flat roofs, and ribbon windows, and made them organic, privileging forms and materials that drew on and integrated with the natural world. rather than leaving the edges of his cantilevered balconies razor straight and dazzlingly white, he rounded their edges and painted them the color of Pueblo adobe. He clad the walls with local sandstone and fronted the cabinets with lustrous North Carolina walnut. Fallingwater made modernism seem romantic, lyrical, and deeply American. As the historian Franklin Toker wrote in his 2003 book, Fallingwater Rising, the house changed Americans' view of modernism from something foreign and suspect to something homegrown and patriotic. Fallingwater also resurrected Wright's moribund career. Before long, pictures of the home were everywhere, especially the indelible shot taken from the base of the falls, the house soaring over those rushing cataracts. In January 1938 alone, Wright graced the cover of Time, with Fallingwater in the background, and Architectural Forum dedicated an entire issue to his work, with the Kaufman House as his crowning achievement. That month, even MoMA, the site of Wright's 1932 snub, dedicated a show to the Kaufman House. Wright was undoubtedly the world's greatest living architect, the critic Lewis Mumford gushed in The New Yorker. He can swing a cantilever across space, using the method of construction not as a cliché of modernism, but as a rational engineering solution of a real problem. Of course, Mumford had only seen the house in pictures and had no idea that those glorious cantilevers were the real problem. The sagging, cracking parapets and engineering error on Wright's part never prevented the Kaufmans from using the house. They did, however, concern Edgar Kaufman Sr. enough that he measured them regularly from 1941 until his death in 1955. In any event, cracks and deflections are hardly visible in photos, and Fallingwater, perhaps more than any Wright building, makes for an iconic, unforgettable image, says architecture historian Barry Bergdahl. The engineers who turned up in 1995 did manage to rescue the house from its builder's dazzling, flawed vision. But to judge Fallingwater based solely on its engineering is to miss the point. Durability alone would never have satisfied Wright's ambitions, nor would it have won Fallingwater its singular place in American architectural history. In 1963, Edgar Kaufman Jr., a Wright acolyte, donated the house to the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, which opened Fallingwater to the public the following year. Over the past six decades, some 6.3 million have visited, mainly lay people, who tend to love Wright more than architects do. Unlike a lot of modernist buildings, Fallingwater is a visceral and emotional experience more than an intellectual one, Wagoner says. It evokes the American desire to exalt nature and dominate it, to claim modernity and reject it. It is an imperfect house and a perfect expression of the American landscape it inhabits, fragile and well worth saving. That completes the article, Soaring Ambition, by Michael Snyder. The second article is a companion article to the first article I just read. The title is Right Hand Woman. That's spelled W-R-I-G-H-T. Too often forgotten, Marion Mahoney Griffin was an inventive and remarkable architect, by Michael Snyder. Marion Mahoney graduated with a bachelor's degree in architecture from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1894, only the second woman in the school's history to do so. A year later, the Chicago native became Frank Lloyd Wright's first employee at his upstart architecture firm in her hometown. A brilliant graphic artist with a deep interest in Japanese printmaking, Mahoney created the signature aesthetic of Wright's perspective drawings, bursting with exquisite detail. She also made the drawings for fully half of the 100 lithographs in the 1910 Wasmuth Portfolio, a compendium of Wright's creations that inspired a generation of European architects, changing the course of 20th century design. Never quick to cede credit, Wright rarely acknowledged his enormous debt to this brilliant young colleague. Indeed, Mahoney took over some projects entirely, as when Wright abandoned his family and practiced to move to Europe in 1909, leaving Mahoney, along with her colleague Hermann V. von Holst, to complete the designs for several houses in Illinois and Michigan. For the landscape designs of some of these projects, she collaborated closely with a former Wright employee named Walter Burley Griffin. The two married in 1911 and shortly after submitted a winning plan for Australia's new federal capital city of Canberra. From 1914 to 1936, the Griffins lived and worked in Australia, dedicating much of their time to town planning and an architecture that could capture and cultivate a spirit of democracy. And that completes the article, Right Hand Woman, by Michael Snyder. This article's title is Poetry in Pro-Motion, How the Dubious Tradition of Song Sharking Led to a Strangely Beautiful Repository of Folk Art, by Luke Savage. As popular music grew into a mass industry in the early 20th century, a murky assortment of companies popped up and began a practice that came to be known as song sharking. Advertisements enjoined ordinary Americans to send in their original poems and lyrics, which the company would set to music for a rather large fee, a few hundred dollars, depending on the year. Early song sharking companies in the 1910s merely set customers' lyrics to sheet music and mailed the sheaves to the customer as a collector's item. In later decades, sharking companies enlisted whole teams of session musicians to give people's submissions the full-blown studio treatment and put them on records. And while many Americans were no doubt satisfied with the novelty of hearing someone on the gramophone singing their lyrics, many song-sharking advertisements dangled a further enticement, the seductive proposition that fame and success in the music business might be just a cashier's check and a postage stamp away. The advertisements, typically nestled inside popular magazines and supermarket tabloids, tended to address readers with the smarmy cadence of a door-to-door salesman, hinting at the possibility of a big payday. Mail your song poem on love, peace, victory, or any other subject to us today, announces an emblematic example from a 1922 issue of Illustrated World. We revise song poems, compose music for them, and guarantee to secure publication on a royalty basis by a New York music publisher. Of course, most of these song poems had no life beyond the LPs that companies mailed to paying customers. Of an estimated 200,000 songs that companies produced from the lyrics of would-be folk lyricists between 1900 and the early 2000s, when the practice petered out, not one ever became a hit. Still, the enterprise struck as a deeply rooted American desire to win fame and fortune instantly, based on one's own exquisite originality. As poetry, the lyrics could run the gamut from generic and derivative to just plain weird. But buoyed by the musicianship of studio professionals and sharpened by the formal conventions of popular songwriting, the effect could be earnest, whimsical, even charming, and plenty of paying customers seem to have been quite happy with the results. In the 1990s, song poems thus acquired a cult following among Americana collectors, and now enjoy a second life thanks to various compilations, perhaps most notably the 2003 CD The American Song Poem Anthology, a testament to their status as an unfiltered, radically democratic form of outsider art. I love pop music, Phil Milstein, who produced that album, remarked in an NPR interview shortly after its release. But I'm aware that for great pop songwriters, there's always some mediation between life experience and the craft of the finished work. With song poem music, there is no such mediation. It's a much purer expression of human thought. And that completes that article, Poetry in Promotion, by Luke Savage. This article's title is When Ornithology Grew Up, by Tim Gallagher. Arthur Allen changed science forever with one simple idea: stop killing rare birds. Arthur Allen carefully packed his camera and luggage at his home in Ithaca, New York. He would soon head south to the backwoods swamps of Osceola County, Florida, to search for a ghost bird, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Most scientists considered it extinct. Allen was desperate to prove them wrong. The year was 1924, and Allen was an energetic ornithology professor at Cornell University, about to take a sabbatical. A stocky, outgoing man with a bushy mustache, he'd always been popular with his students, who called him Doc Allen, and liked how he never talked down to them. He'd been born and raised in working-class Buffalo, New York, moving to Ithaca in 1904 to study at Cornell, and never left. Allen was not the first to be enthralled by this charismatic bird, the largest woodpecker in the U.S., with stunning black-and-white plumage, gleaming white bill, and yellow eyes. In the 18th century, the English artist and naturalist Mark Catesby described the bird and painted it for the first volume of his Natural History of Carolina, Florida, and the Bahama Islands, published in 1731. The bird later caught the attention of several early 19th century naturalists, including artists Alexander Wilson and John James Audubon, who included paintings of the species in their books. For artistic accuracy, they collected a few specimens, which was not a problem at that point, but that soon changed as people cut down vast tracts of forest to make way for farmland, destroying vital habitats. They also killed many birds for commercial gain, driving some species to extinction, most notably the passenger pigeon, which was shot by the millions as food for people and livestock. Allen was obsessive about studying birds, especially species that were vanishing, At this point, the great auk, passenger pigeon, and Carolina parakeet were already extinct, and most thought the ivory-billed woodpecker was also gone. Allen was determined to spend months, if necessary, scouring Florida in search of this bird, to study the species in depth and take photographs. The trip would herald a new era in ornithology, one where scientists stopped killing rare birds and started trying to keep them alive. Before 1796, when French scientist Georges Cuvier first proposed the concept of extinction, people didn't know a species could be lost forever. The idea that any of God's creatures could just vanish from the earth was simply unthinkable. In the previous decade, Thomas Jefferson had written, "Such is the economy of nature that no instance can be produced of her having permitted any one race of her animals to become extinct." And yet, in the Victorian era, when people did become aware that species could be lost, it only heightened their interest in shooting them to add to collections. The Victorian age was the heyday of specimen collecting, especially birds and their eggs, and the species closest to extinction were the ones most prized. "Now is the time to collect," wrote W.T. Hornaday, then the Smithsonian's chief taxidermist, in an 1891 book. "The time will come when the majority of the vertebrate species now inhabiting the earth will be either totally exterminated or exist only under protection." Prominent figures in ornithology were involved in the slaughter. William Brewster, co-founder and an early president of the American Ornithologists Union, or AOU, now the American Ornithological Society, owned more than 40,000 specimens and later became curator of Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. He shot many birds himself and bought rare bird carcasses from other enthusiasts, including his friend Arthur T. Wayne. After one trip in 1892, Wayne wrote Brewster that he had collected 43 Bachmann's warblers, a bird now extinct, and 13 fine ivory-billed woodpeckers. Wayne later placed an advertisement on the back cover of the AOU's journal, The Auk, offering 4 pairs of ivory bills for sale. It appeared below an ad for repeating rifles. Scientists certainly knew what was happening with the ivory bill. The probabilities are that the ivory-billed woodpecker would soon be extinct, wrote naturalist Charles Abbott in 1894. "It is too handsome not to tempt every collector, taxidermist, and millinery establishment in the country, and he who protests will be laughed at for his trouble." Besides the birds being killed by collectors, millions of herons, egrets, and other birds were being slaughtered for the fashion industry to provide adornments for women's hats and other garments. Yet some began to blanch at this cruel ostentation. A group of wealthy society women in Boston began arranging boycotts of feathered garments and eventually formed the Massachusetts Audubon Society, dedicated to bird conservation. Soon more Audubon societies were formed in other cities and states, but these conservationists were not always taken seriously by professional ornithologists, who often viewed them as parochial animal lovers and laughed at their efforts. When AOU President Charles B. Corey was invited to attend an Audubon Society meeting in 1902, he replied, "I do not protect birds, I kill them." Arthur Allen was different. He cared deeply about living birds and dedicated himself to studying them. No one had ever done an in-depth study of an ivory-billed woodpecker, and though he knew the bird might already be extinct, he felt he had to try. Florida had been a stronghold for ivory bills in past decades, and was where most museum specimens of the bird, which already numbered in the hundreds, had come from. So that's where he set his sights. Perhaps he could find some forgotten nook of the state, where a few of them still managed to hang on. The problem was where to look. Florida is huge, and he had a limited amount of time. He advertised that he was willing to pay for information that could point him to a living ivory bill. He heard from several people and spent nearly a month checking their claims, but the birds all turned out to be common pileated woodpeckers. Then a rancher named Morgan Tyndale got in touch, claiming he'd seen an ivory bill less than 30 miles from where Arthur Allen and his wife, fellow ornithologist Elsa, were staying. Tyndale's description of the bird was spot on, so they arranged to spend a few days camping with him near where he'd seen it. He was sitting in his battered Ford Model T when the Allens arrived at their meeting place. He was a tall, wiry man in his 60s with a droopy gray walrus mustache and a flat-brimmed Stetson. The Allens quizzed him about his sighting and listened closely as he talked about all the ivory bills he'd seen over the years while working cattle. And unfortunately, we have run out of time today. The name of this article was When Ornithology Grew Up by Tim Gallagher. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program and found it informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Podcast Demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.